Shall we start, Doctor?
Yep. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. This is Mani from Jersey City. This is our fourth community awareness conference call. Thank you very much, Dr. Saravanan and Atma, for coordinating with multiple doctors in a short time and arranging this. Next, I would like to thank Dr. Deepa Nedunjalian, Dr. Saraswati Mupanna, and Mr. Mahesh Narayanan very much for joining us in spite of their busy schedule and educating the community in this COVID-19 awareness conference call. Dr. Saravanan, would you like to kickstart the meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Mani. Vanakkam. Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Saravanan Ramalingam, Governor, New York, New Jersey Chapter. We are very happy to have this conference call. As you said, it is for the fourth for the everyone, and we did history for the physician too. And I welcome Dr. Deepa Nedunjalian, infectious disease specialist, and she's working very hard, tirelessly. She did a lot of conferences. And I welcome Dr. Saraswati Mupanna. She's a pulmonary critical care sleep medicine specialist in Harvard Hospitals in Massachusetts. And I welcome Mr. Mahesh Narayanan, and CEO of PepFex. I mean, he's got a lot of research experience. And thank you very much for all the, I mean, everyone and all the audience for this. Before I give it to Mani, I would like to talk 1 minute about COVID-19 Tamil task team. So we created along with the American Tamil Medical Association, New York, New Jersey chapter, we started a task team called COVID-19 Tamil task team. It basically helps the people who are in need, any kind of help, like groceries, information, etc. We do have a hotline, we do have email and a separate website. Please visit the website and enjoy the conference call. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Saravanan. Next, I would like to ask Dr. Deepa Nedunjalian, what would you like to share with people who are on call today regarding this COVID-19 pandemic?
Good afternoon, and actually I should say good evening, depends on the different area. My name is Deepa Nedunjalian. I'm a retired infectious disease physician, and this has been a very sober moment for infectious disease community, and we have dealt with different epidemics and viral infections, but nothing of this caliber, nothing of this virulence of the virus. So, and also, so this is very new to the whole world as well as the community. And I would like to share today the number of cases in the United States, which has been more than what has been predicted to happen. I think we were all under the impression by this time we will have maybe around 50,000 cases. That was the prediction before. But now we are over 85,000 cases and about more than 2,000 deaths, which is, if you're looking at the statistics, why it comes to roughly about somewhere around 1.1% or 1.5%. And other situation, I suppose, as you're all aware, that the global situation is also worsening. We have more than 200,000 cases globally. That is, if you know, if you put together all of it, it's almost 250,000 people who are infected with COVID in the regular terms. And also you see the resources of all the different countries being strained. And then we are coming to the point of rationing treatment to different kinds of people. Very unique situation in our entire world, and the way we are have ever dealt with in the modern era of the last 20 to 25 years post-World War a boom in any of the portion of the world. And one important thing which I just want to mention among the statistics is that is in United States for the for the contrast to rest of the country, we are seeing increase in COVID cases among the younger people. I'm talking about people less than 40 who actually have no previous health issues, who are healthy, but who are working, and probably many of them were exposed to COVID cases from others, maybe somewhere along Healthcare Limited or somewhere in that area, and also causing death in this group of people disproportionately than what has happened in the rest of the country. That is very alarming for us. We do not know what is the reason. Probably in a few days or weeks, we will get the characteristics. And I think that is about where I'm going to stop. And then there will be a lot of questions. And I'm trying to look forward to answering all of the questions. And I'm going to leave it with a little positive note. Even though we were a little, we lagged behind a little bit in our preparedness in the beginning of the COVID, now with the testing, different kinds of testing which are available, and the identification and the restrictions which are put on, we are probably at an aggressive area. We still need to get more aggressive, and we still need to get a lot more protection for our healthcare people and others like general public who are catering to the public also. So with that, I'm going to stop, and then I'm going to pass it on to Dr. Saraswati Mopanna. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Deepta. Yes, Dr. Saraswati Mopanna, what would you like to share with the people who are on call today about this COVID-19 pandemic?
So I would like to, first of all, I would like to thank Atma for giving me this opportunity and to help the community and serve on this platform. And I also would like to personally thank Dr. Saravanan to include me in this discussion. So my background is a pulmonary critical care specialist and a sleep medicine specialist as well. I'm going to first talk briefly about the clinical features, what exactly are the clinical features the patients come with, and my experiences in my own community clinic as well. So they think the incubation period for this is the exact incubation period is not known. However, mostly we think it's anywhere from 2 days to 14 days. And most of the cases, they occur within 5 days after exposure. That's what some of the literature says. And the spectrum of this illness is different. It could be from mild to critical. So patients can have fever. 80 or 80% more of the patients can have fever. They can have dry cough. They can also feel short of breath. If the patients are having underlying asthma or COPD, the cough is a little different from what they can experience. You should always ask them questions whether it's the same kind of cough they have as an asthma episode or as a COPD or a bronchitis episode. If it's different, then that's something to think about. And it's mostly a dry cough. That's one thing to keep in mind. And these patients, they have unexplained fatigue. They feel so fatigued for no reason at all suddenly. And that's one thing to keep in mind as well. And they could also have generalized body pain. And patients, the mild illness is reported in 81% of the patients. Severe illness where patients' oxygen, the lungs get affected and the oxygen numbers also start dropping. It's known to happen in around 14% of the patients. And then the next stage after that would be the critical disease, where the patients are really, really sick. They go into respiratory failure. Oxygen numbers are dropping, and they're not able to maintain their own oxygen numbers. And multiple organs in the body, like the kidneys, the heart, they get affected, along with the lungs, they get affected as well, which is called the multi-organ dysfunction syndrome. And patients can go into shock. And this number of patients, it's around 5%. So most of the mild illnesses are reported in 80-plus group of patients. So this is what I would like to stop here. And any questions anybody has, I'm happy to help. I do want to include, though, few of the symptoms which are noted are headache. Few patients can have headache. Few patients can have sore throat, running nose. They can have GI symptoms as well, which is very important, like the nausea, vomiting. Patients can have belly, abdominal pain. They can have diarrhea. So that's something to keep in mind as well. So I would like to stop here, please, for further questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Sarasvathi Upanna. Now, Mr. Makesh Narayanan, what would you like to share with people who are on call today?
Great. Thank you for this opportunity, and happy to share my thoughts and where we are. My background has been in biotechnology. I did my master's in biotechnology from the University of Pennsylvania with a background in immunology and oncology. My company, PepVax, has been very active in COVID-19 for the past couple months. And I just wanted to tell people where we are in the research for vaccines, treatments, and diagnostics, and how we plan to move forward and try to contain this as soon as we can. Just to give you an overarching view of where we are in the research perspective, there are about 40 different vaccines that are being developed right now, about 20 different monoclonal antibodies, 20 different transfusion methodologies with plasma from recovered patients for transfusion, and about 15 brand new treatments. And our company is one of the 15 companies working on a brand new treatment. We're not necessarily going after a vaccine. Vaccines are usually used to prevent spread, although they can be used for treatment as well. We're going directly towards the treatment for most of the immunodeficient patients that are currently suffering from COVID-19 already. Just to give a little bit of background, vaccines are usually parts of the antigen of the virus presented back into the patient to try to create some kind of immune response against it. And most individuals, especially if they're in a healthier, they're able to fight this off. We have seen a lot of patients that have had milder cases, and that's usually because the body is able to fight it off. But depending on the age group, a lot of them are having a lot of trouble creating the right type of antibodies and antiviral cytokines to fight this particular virus. And even though we've had a lot of experience with SARS and MERS, back in early 2000s, this is still a very different virus. SARS, we had about 2,000 cases, and we were able to contain it very quickly, and it pretty much died off on its own once we started the quarantine. That's not been the case with this particular virus. It's it's been within the span of 2 months, it's infected a lot of patients very, very quickly. So we're still learning a lot about this virus, and that's actually one of the reasons we haven't really created a vaccine already, because it's not the same as the SARS we used to fight. There's still a lot of development, still a lot of work ahead of us. And I'll stop there. I'm sure a lot of people have questions about where we are in our research, and I'll answer those questions separately.
Thank you very much, Mr. Makesh Narayanan. Now, dear callers, we are going to open the question and answer session. So please make your question short and related to COVID-19 worry. And as soon as I click Start Q&A, an IVR would say Q&A session has started. Then you have to press *6 and then press 1 to add yourself in the queue. Let me repeat it. So as soon as I click Start Q&A, the IVR would say Q&A session has started. Then you have to press *6 and then again press 1 to add yourself in the queue to ask questions. So let me start it.
Hello. This is Dr. Saravanan Ramalingam. Just for a disclosure, all the speakers, with Atma and COVID Talk Team, we do not have any financial.
Muted.
Hello.
Dr. Sinan, yeah, there was an interruption. You can go ahead now.
Okay, sorry. I'm just repeating. All the speakers, Dr. Deepta, Dr. Mupana, and Mr. Mahesh, we do not have any financial relationship. Everything is for social service. No financial relationship between Atma, New York, New Jersey, or COVID Task Team, or any of the organizations. Thank you. And please go ahead and start the Q&A session.
Callers, again, one more thing. You have to press star 6. Then you have to press 1 to ask a question, to add yourself in the queue. Again, star 6 first, then again, number 1 to add yourself in the queue. Go ahead. The number starts with 2810. You can ask the question. Jyoti Anandan.
Hi, this is Kanti Jyoti Anandan. I have one question. If a person gets this viral infection, do they need a negative test to go back to work?
I will take that question.
Okay, and if the patient is positive for coronavirus and if they wanted to go back to work after 14 days of quarantine or whatever, so do they need a negative test before they going back to work?
I will take that question. It is officially in the studies in which they conducted, they want a 2 negative tests before going to work or to show up or to take them out of the isolation. And I think that is probably the right way to do it. But knowing that we have so many people who are infected with the virus and we are putting them on quarantine, on self-isolation at home, and the test not being available that quickly, at this point, as the symptoms resolve and they are without symptoms for 48 hours, there is probably most of the private physicians may be releasing them out to work. You need to check with your hospital policy. I would suggest that most of the hospitals are probably looking for 2 negative tests before you go. And I also want to throw another caution. Even though you may have a negative test, that does not necessarily mean you don't have the virus. If we look at the original, if you look at the Wuhan group, people who had COVID symptoms several times had negative tests, and the test became only positive on the 8th, 9th day later on during from the incubation period. But positive test also does not mean everybody has active virus. Sometimes positive test means it's just a viral particle which may be also non-active. With all that put in, I think if you're a healthcare worker, most likely your medical center will need a negative test. That probably is the golden proof at this point for you to say you may not have the virus. I hope I answered the question.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Deepa. Deepa, so for all the callers, whoever joined new, if you want to ask a question, plus press star 6, then press 1 again to add yourself in the queue.
So can I jump in for the previous call question?
Sure. Go ahead, doctor.
So if I'm wrong, please correct me, Dr. Deepta, but I also read in the studies that there are 2 negatives with 24 hours apart to be cleared for patients, especially who are very critically ill in the ICU and getting discharged and things like that. Yes, availability of we don't have so much of testing available and we don't have the luxury of testing them again. So that's one thing, but I think a part of the literature also says 2 samples, negative samples, 24 hours apart.
Oh, I'm sorry. I must have missed 48 hours. Yes, 24 hours. But in a hospital, it is at least a little better when you discharge them from ICU, you're putting into another area, they're going to convalesce and go. If they're going back to work, I think they need to be much clearer. I'm sorry. I thought it was 48 hours. Thank you for the correction.
Thank you, Dr. Saraswati, and thank you, Dr. Deepta. Go ahead, Dr. Saraswati. Would you like to say something else?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you, Dr. Saraswati. Next question, Susai Muthu. Susai Muthu, can you hear me? The number that ends with 0934. Hello, Susai Muthu, can you hear me?
Press star 6.
Okay, let's move on to the next question. If Susimadhu want to join the line back, press star 6 and then press 1 again to join the queue again. Let me press next question. Gauri? Hello, Gauri?
Did you unmute?
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Yes. Sinhar, yes,
yeah.
Go ahead with your question.
Can I ask questions?
Sure.
Have any one of you seen a patient coming with loss of taste and loss of smell with this coronavirus as the only symptoms, no other symptoms?
Mr. Sinha, can you repeat your question once again? A little louder, please.
Yeah, patient coming with symptoms of insomnia, cannot smell, cannot taste. Have any one of you has seen a patient with COVID-19 who has loss of taste and loss of smell?
I think I will answer that. I am not, I've only heard of that in the literature. In the ENT literature, it's been said that it is one of the first symptoms they've seen on COVID patients, which is loss of smell. And when you have loss of smell, the loss of taste goes along with the smell, because that is a normal connection if you can't smell. They have put that as one of the symptoms to be alerted for people. So nowadays they said that if anybody comes in with sort of, say, any other things, general things, or they complain about loss of smell, please be aware and get the COVID test done. And then even if they are negative, ask them to self-isolate for a few days, because usually may they progress on to have other symptoms of fever, and they can be wait for another 3-4 days by the time the symptoms develop. If there's none other symptom develop at that point, you can probably, with a negative COVID test, you can release them off. This is one of the criteria they did. This happened about a week to 10 days ago, where they had announced that. And I think it is something new, and we need to, again, it is probably is a mechanism to be maybe local inflammation of the nasal passages where the smell receptors are there, and it does affect us, you know, the epithelium and the nasal passages. So that may be related to that. And
the center of smell is right on the frontal, and that's how it gets affected. So I think people are not talking about that there are report coming out, patient can present with sudden loss of smell and sudden loss of taste. So that should be kept in mind to evaluate for COVID-19. That's what my point was.
Yes.
The other question I have is, what's the sensitivity and specificity for all these different tests for COVID-19? Because we have several tests available now. Some of them are not good, some of them are okay, but we need to know as a doctor before we order which tests are more specific and which tests are more sensitive. And do you have any data on that?
I can tell you the data on the sensitivity and specificity for the PCR test. All the PCR tests are all done on the same platform, and so I can't tell you from individual company. I can tell you from what was available from the Wuhan area. In fact, I just answered that question this afternoon, so let me read what I've written.
Okay.
Normally, if you do a COVID test, and if the way they confirmed this particular data is, in Wuhan, they did testing, and then they immediately went to CT scan. They did three cuts of CT scan. That's all, three or four cuts, low-level cuts of CT scan, and they compared it with this all happened as they progressed and they're looking back at it. And they decided to do the PCR testing and then the CT scan. As they were doing it, within 2 to 3 weeks, the 2 weeks, they realized the CT scan is much more sensitive than the PCR testing. So as soon as people walked in, they have COVID-like symptoms, they usually took them to CT scan, and they did the CT scan. That is how they found out that the PCR test can be negative. The range of PCR, which is negative on a positive CT scan, is anywhere between 15 to 30%.
That's a huge number,
Yeah. But on a range of about 11 to 20% is the range. But the 15 to 30 is on the other extension on both sides. And so that is why they decided that the CT scan is negative. Another thing they also did is if the person had symptoms and they had COVID-like symptoms, and if the initial PCR is negative, then they made them come back again after a few days of symptoms and they did the PCR. The reason for a negative PCR could be they did not get adequate sample or they did not have adequate viruses multiplying at that particular area the way they collected it, and it's a negativity, and then there's also issue of transportation and things like that. And the other way looking at it is to see is to how many times you got false positive PCR. That means it came back as COVID positive. There was nothing in the X-ray. It was really not COVID. And that was another one also you need to think about it, because we need to worry about how many times we are putting in people who are not COVID positive or negative. And I think that one also I'll tell you about that. Usually that the false negative is on a range one much lower, in the range of about 5 to 9%. So false negative is less, whereas the false positive goes in the range of 15 to 30%. The higher, the more shortness of breath, more symptoms, you definitely have a CT scan which is positive. And if you happen to have laboratory values added to it, then you can look at, even though it's a COVID negative test, you can look at the white count, your CPR, and now they're, your CRP, now they're adding LDH. And those are done, which are very easily done as an outpatient. And if you want, if you're in a clinic which is attached to the hospital, they might be able to do a D-dimer. So if you can look at that, and then if you still had a negative PCR, you can still continue to treat the patient as if COVID, and then you can then take it from there as to how you want to manage it. It is not a perfect test. It does have definite false positivity.
Dr. Gita and Dr. Sinha, and Dr. Sinha, thank you very much for your question. For time constraint, we'll keep one question. And also, Dr. Sinha, one point about anosmia. I do practice in New York State. Yes, some of the people have anosmia with a positive. The problem is, it's very difficult for the people to catch up the anosmia. I mean, some of them are smart, they catch up. And also for the physicians in here, please restrict with the one question. And this question is for physicians, but predominantly for the people. We don't want to bore them with a lot of medical discussion. We do have a session in 2 days on Tuesday for physicians, predominantly for physicians. Thank you very much. Mani, can you go ahead with the next
question? Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Saravanan. Next question, and thank you, Dr. Deepta. Next question is for 8447. The number ends with 8447. Please ask your question.
Hey, the doctor explained everything on the precautionary things and all, but I want to know, like, because recently a lot of people are getting a lot of issues going on. The counts are going increasing much over here. So for going out for groceries or going for pickup up or whatever maybe, so it's going to be really is it safe or just without wearing any mask or any cloth or something like that? So, doctor, can you please give some instructions what we have to do when we go for out for groceries or something? Because we can't sit out for a long time at our house. So, please, your advice, please.
Saraswati, you want to take that case, the question?
Sure, happy to take that. So, yes, we do need to go out to get our essentials, to get our groceries or things like that. But what I would suggest is to restrict the visits when you're going out as much as possible. What I tell my other patients and everybody is to write down a list of things that you need beforehand at home. And call the grocery store if you can, if that's the provision that they allow, and ask them to keep all the provisions, whatever you need, aside. And you go and don't touch anything there. Just go pick up your groceries. And I suggest that you keep the time what you spend in your grocery shop as less as possible, less than 10 minutes. That's one thing. And two is, you do have to wash your hands after you come home, and you also have to wash if there's in a plastic bag, the groceries are in a plastic bag, or the milk can, and these things, you do have to wash them. That's what I would do. That's what I do too at home. Wash them nicely and wash your hands as well. And it's really, people say, okay, should I wear gloves and go to the grocery shop? I think that's not indicated. Not everybody has access to gloves or access to masks, but regular hand washing and social distancing, those are the key things which are going to help you in the long, help us all in this marathon race we are having. Dr. Deepta, would you like to add anything else?
I think that's about it. And if you're going to the stores, I would say if you have a delivery system which is optional, which is available, please you make use of the delivery system. And also, try to pool with your family and friends. So if you're going to the store, and if your friends and family will want to need it, you there buy them all for all of them too, so that you can deliver them at their doorstep and you can come in. In that way, your exposure going to outside will be limited. So everybody sort of shares in their turn. That's one. And when you go to the store, make sure that they are wiping the handles and things like that. And do not touch everything. Just pick up what you want. Many of the people are wearing gloves now, which may be reasonable for you to do that. You can wear a vinyl glove and pick it up. And then when you get into the car, before you get into the car, throw the gloves. And then you can come back. Make sure that you wash your hands all the way up to your elbows, because you may be touching things on the other area, you know, like in the arm, forearm and things like that. And up to the elbow and the proper hand washing you need to do. Continue to do hand washing at home also, because you come in, you may touch, continue to do the hand washing. So I think we need to just take care of ourselves at this point and make sure we don't spread it to others.
And can I make another point here as well? Thank you, Dr. Yeah, Mahesh. Go ahead, Mahesh.
So just 2 points I wanted to make. One is, if you go out, even if you're wearing gloves, just avoid touching your face. You know, your eyes, your nose, and your mouth are the easiest ways to get the virus in. So just because you're wearing the gloves doesn't make it any safer to touch your face. So if you're going out, make sure you wash your hands often, but also you're wearing gloves, or even if you're not wearing gloves, just avoid touching your face as much as possible. And the other aspect is fruits and vegetables are porous, so they're very similar to your skin. So it's very easy for the virus to get in there as well. So just wash any fruits or vegetables just like you would your hands. So at least 20 seconds. If you want to use soap, please do that as well. And just make sure that you wash it thoroughly before eating any fruits or vegetables, especially if it's coming from a grocery store. But even if it's been at home, washing it's better.
Could I add something as well, please?
Yes, go ahead, Dr. Shalsodhi.
So one more thing is, as Mahesh was saying, it's really important when you touch the surfaces in the shop or anywhere else outside your home and you feel it's not safe, the most important thing is not to touch your eyes, nose, and mouth. That's how it goes through the mucosal membrane. That's how the virus gets into us, right? And it's also important not to touch your hair. That's another thing, too. Mm-hmm. And I'm a right-hand dominant person, so what I do is opening the doorknobs opening the car handles and car doors and everything else, whatever you need to touch. Usually one of the things, thought process is do it with your non-dominant hand. Do it with your left hand, if possible, if you're a right-handed person. So that way, the non-dominant hand, the number of occurrences that goes to your face is less compared to your dominant hand. That's another thing also just to keep in mind. And the hair, please take care of the hair as well.
Thank you, Dr. Saraswati. Even I did read that in an article in South Korea, they did that non-dominant hand practice. So, well, thank you, Dr. Saraswati, and thank you, Makesh. And one more thing is we also have some of the common FAQs added in COVID-19TamilTaskTeam.org. That is the FAQ page. We have added a lot of common questions in there. You can check it out. So next caller, Sriji Sridharan. Sriji Sridharan, the number ends with 7809.
My question is, if we find a cure for this, I want to know how the cure might be administered. Will insurance be covering it in the U.S.? And will the same be shared with other countries? And just looking forward, I feel that we will find a cure soon. But when I say soon, it's relatively speaking. But do you have any idea how it might be administered to the public? Will it be shared with the other countries? Thank you.
I think
I don't mind taking this question. Just to let everyone know, as much as we are doing a lot of treatments, most of these vaccines and treatments are still very, very early. A lot of them are still in animal studies. I believe there are only about two or three new drugs that are being pushed into clinical trials. There are a lot of clinical trials of repurposed drugs. So drugs that have already been tested and are safe in humans and are currently being repurposed to use for this particular virus. So for a direct vaccine or treatment for this particular virus, it's going to take maybe, I would say, best bet 12 months, most realistically speaking, 18 months is how long it's going to take to get a vaccine that actually fights this out completely. And it's made specific for this particular virus. And I know that seems a really long way out, but unfortunately drug development does take a long time. That doesn't mean that we're not going to be able to find something that can treat this virus. There are two ways we've seen SARS die out. One, and that was herd immunity. So eventually everyone in the population just developed immunity against the virus and it died out. We're able to quarantine enough people that it does eventually die out. And that's how most viruses, at least major pandemics, have stopped in the past, not with vaccines, but with automatically, kind of going through its cycle and degrading and enough people getting immunity against it. So in terms of a cure, it's still a long way out. But there are many repurposed drugs that are being tested, and some of them have shown anecdotal evidence that it works. We are still doing clinical trials on those. So I wouldn't say there's anything out there that actually treats this 100% of the time. We don't know that yet. Some might, but we are currently conducting clinical trials for that to verify the anecdotal cases. So so that's pretty much where I would leave it off in terms of a cure or a vaccine coming up just for COVID-19. It's a little way off. We hopefully get there fast. And in terms of sharing this, I would say if we do create a vaccine, it should be available to everyone, any country. I don't think it's going to be restricted. Just like we've done with polio, just like we've done with influenza, every country will have access to it. So I don't think it's going to be limited to one country or the other. Where you make money, that's going to be different. But I think the access should be 100% of the world. And vaccines are covered pretty much exclusively by every insurance company in the United States, and this will fall under the same category. We're not creating anything 100% new, or at least if we do, that will be covered as well. So insurance should cover it, especially as a pandemic. I don't think it should be an issue. The government will at least enforce some regulations against insurance not covering these type of treatments, and it should be available to everyone at little or no cost to get this vaccine or cure eventually when we get there.
Thank you, Mr. Mahesh Narayanan. Dr. Deepa or Dr. Mupanna, would you like to add anything?
I think I just want to tell us two things, and then Dr. Mupanna can tell her about this. The hard experience with what's happening in the hospital, which is actually treating patients with medications. And as he said, that there are only three or four medications which are actively being used on COVID patients, and in that they are hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, and lopinavir, ritonavir, which is one medication combination called Calitra, and remdesivir. And also, I think, Favipiravir or something like that, which is another medication. That's about all they're using. And out of this, anecdotally, in patients who have moderate pneumonia, the combination medications, moderate to severe pneumonia, the combination medication of hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, and remdesivir seem to have had some effect on the people in China. They will be releasing the report. There are two studies which have come, which are back-to-back studies which have different results. Lopinavir, ritonavir in New England Journal of Medicine, the full article came in this week, but the initial report came 2 weeks ago in Wuhan area. They did not have any effect. But again, in China, there are places where lopinavir, ritonavir seem to have effect. So some countries are using that. And the azithromycin is added just not because of COVID infection. They believe that the azithromycin might also affect other bacteria in our body as may be present, because it is, you have a combination of different elements in the body at the same time. And we do not have a cure at this time. So this is a trial on in the month of May, which is going to be, all of the results will be released soon. We would have a better idea of how to take care of patients. Thank you. Because Saraswati, you need to give your active experience in hospitals now.
Sure.
Thank you,
sure.
Dr. Deepa.
Thank you.
Thank you. What we are doing in our hospital is, it has to be approved. If the patients are really sick, their oxygen numbers are dropping, lungs are affected, they're in under monitoring, then it has to be supervised. It has to be okayed by an infectious disease specialist. So we are giving hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. As Dr. Deepa was also mentioning, they do have their toxicities as well. They cause QT prolongation, and it's really important to monitor these patients. So they don't have these QT prolongations, and it doesn't cause any death as well. So that's one. But talking about the other trials, there's one thing. It's called the tocilizumab. This is a monoclonal antibody. It is thought, one of the thought processes, the COVID-19 causes the cytokine storm, and the interleukin-6 is what is known to occur more in these patients. So it's trying to see if this monoclonal antibody can help in taking care of these patients. These are all experimental still, but it's not FDA approved as far as I know. So that's one thing. Then I've also seen one main thing is in the critical care or in the severely ill patients, corticosteroids is not indicated. So that's one thing we don't give. And the other one is the IV immunoglobulins. That's another thing which is going on. I think in New York, I believe there are some studies which are Mount Sinai, I believe, is conducting a trial there. It's mainly the antibodies from this convalescent plasma, and the thought process is it suppresses the viremia. That's one thing. And I've also seen some small studies on IV vitamin C. That's another thing also. And if Mahesh or Dr. Deepa can add anything on this.
Thank you, Dr. Mupanna. So, shall we move to the next question? Nithyanand Senthil. Nithyanand Senth, the number that ends with 5518, you can ask a question. There are over 300 callers. So, for all the new callers, just I have an announcement that if you want to ask a question, press *6, then again press 1. so that you can add yourself in the queue to ask questions. Thank you. You can go ahead, Cynthia.
Yeah, last Monday, I got a fever, like a 99.4 degree Fahrenheit. Then immediately I get back to my primary care physician on the day itself. Then my doctor advised me to be in the self-quarantine. From that point up to this moment, I'm in the self-quarantine. My symptoms are like fever the first day, and after that, the temperature still now it's maintaining. And every day I'm taking a 1,000 mg of Tylenol, and for the cough, I'm taking the Delzyme. I got a severe back pain. It's day by day, it's decreasing, but still the pain is persist. The other thing, today I'm reaching the 7th day self-quarantine. Last 2 days, I had a stuffy nose, and the evening time and the middle, in the afternoon, and it's giving a little bit difficulty in the breathing. So still I'm wondering like whether I have a positive or negative. And tomorrow I'm trying to get the appointment for the testing. So if the testing comes positive, so what are the precautions I should take care? Because I isolated from my family for 7 days in all aspect. And I'd like to get some advice from the doctors. So, yeah, this is my question.
Thank you, sir.
Hello.
Yeah, Dr. Deepa.
Oh, I think yes. I'm so sorry. I lost track of the process.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
I think your symptoms are slow. Looks like they are slowly progressing. It could be any viral infection, but of course, since we are in the area of the COVID at this point, you might have the COVID virus. And I think what you're describing all goes along with the COVID symptoms of fever, progressive, and then upper respiratory infection, shortness of breath, and back pain, as you mentioned, myalgia, muscle pain, and that is also one of the part of that. I think since you have symptoms, we would consider you as still having still active infection. I would suggest that there won't be any treatment offered to you because there is no treatment available. What you're doing is supportive therapy, which is absolutely fine. And you would have to call your physician and talk to them. I have a feeling they may not advise you even to come to the offices. If you can, someday get a COVID test done with proper precaution. That's a possibility. They may be what they call drive-through COVID test centers, which are situated in many of the cities, or they may have outside the hospital, they have COVID testing centers. So you might want to drive through to the area. They will be testing it, or the hospitals have COVID diagnostic area, and they may do it. But most likely, at this point, continue the self-isolation. The way to take yourself off self-isolation is you have to have reduction of fever without using Tylenol for 2 days. So your symptoms seem to be going up now. You have a little more of tough nose congestion. When you come to the point when all of the symptoms resolve and the fever has gone down, take the Tylenol off, wait for 2 days to see whether the fever is all right, completely gone. And you should have improvement in your respiratory symptoms. And this is where you are. And if you have all your symptoms resolved, no fever, 2 more days without any supportive care, then you can take yourself off the, they say actually 72 hours have passed since the recovery of symptoms after that. You can take yourself up. As long as you have shortness of breath, even without fever, I mean, I assume all of this is new. You don't have anything like this before, because if you had shortness of breath before, then that becomes easier. If your shortness of breath is there, that means you probably have the virus still in your lungs. So you need to wait for all of the symptoms and then give yourself another 72 hours. Then you can take yourself off. At that point of time, since your symptoms are mild or all negative, you could probably put on a mask and go to a COVID center and get yourself tested. That will be my advice. You can call your local emergency room, hospital emergency room. They may be willing to see in one of the outside tents, and they test you and they send you home and they'll give you a call. But you need to practice complete infection control for them to go to do all of that stuff, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Deepta. Dr. Mupanna, would you like to add anything?
No.
All right.
Sorry to interrupt. Actually, tomorrow I'm planning to go for the testing. If the testing comes positive, I'm looking for some suggestion what my precaution should be and something like that. That's my question.
Can I take this question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So if your test comes back positive, which state do you live in? Sorry, I missed that part.
Sorry?
In the Woodland Kingdom, which state do you live in, please?
New Jersey.
New Jersey, okay. You do have a primary care physician, right?
Yeah, I do have a primary care physician.
Okay. So if your testing comes back positive, usually you are doing all the right things. You have to keep yourself isolated, and isolation is your own bedroom, your own bathroom, not mixing the utensils, putting your laundry separately. And so all these things have to be really strictly taken care of. And so the other members of the family, right, if you have other members in the family you're living with, it has to be really careful. That's why it is mainly isolation, as Dr. Deepta was also mentioning. And keep yourself, I would also suggest that you buy a small tool. It's called a pulse oximeter. Okay, it's a very small tool where you can put it on just insert it on the finger. There'll be instructions how to use it. And you can check your oxygen numbers too. That's another tool you can have. And it's always, don't be scared and keep checking it every minute. That's not what I'm recommending here. Just like you have a thermometer at home, nowadays, even having a pulse oximeter at home, it's a very useful tool to have. So just keep a watch. If you forget things, just write them down that you had fever at this time or you took a Tylenol at this time. That's a good bookkeeping habit. So when you call your primary care the next day to give your progress, you can always refer back to your book and give them those things. Keep yourself well hydrated. Drink lots of fluids, liquids, and also eat good healthy vegetables, fruits, and good sleep. These are all important measures. And please do not panic. So you have any questions, you should be always able to reach your primary care physician for that. Okay, and we are always here to help you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I want to give one general information to every caller who's listening. If you happen to have one of the new iWatches, if anybody else happens to have one of the new iWatches in the house that the kids tend to wear them, take it out of the kids. And the adults in the family, and especially the person who really has high risk, put them on their arm. You can download there is a pulse ox program, which is in the new iPhone watches. The program, you can put it on. It gives you that. And also it gives you the regular pulse rate. And you tend to have increasing in pulse rate with the shortness of breath as you progress. So you can monitor your pulse rate. Of course, your pulse rate goes up when you walk up and down. That's not a need. When you're just in rest itself, it goes up. You'll see a pattern. So that is a good program that you have. All of us tend to buy all these things, and then we walk around with it. This is a good time for us to make use of the pulse oximeter and the pulse rate in that iWatch.
Thank you, Dr. Deepta. Let's move on to the next question. It's a very useful tip. Thank you very much. And the next question for Sopik Anthony. Number ends with 6731.
Hi, good evening, everybody. I'm calling from the northeast region of the country, and my concern is that we have allergy season coming up very heavily in this part of the country. Do you guys foresee any complications with allergies and people who suffer from them and with this disease?
Can I take this?
Yeah, go ahead.
So if you know you have seasonal allergies of past year and the past few years, I think usually whatever precautions you take, like even if you go to the yard and do your yard work, right, coming back, you keep your hands, you're doing yard work, and then there could be some spores which are getting onto your nose. So it's really important to do regular hand washing. And also, if you take any saline rinse or any inhaled not inhale, nasal corticosteroids like Flonase or Rhinocort, I would suggest that you take them. And if your allergies are that bad and you do need to take an antihistaminic tablet, that's something which is a routine during your season, during this spring season, I would suggest that you continue taking those. It's really important, whatever medical conditions the patients have, it's really important to keep them under check now. And this is not the time to experiment with new medications and everything else. This is the time, like anybody, not just allergies, anybody, I want to take this opportunity and also mention that if patients have cardiovascular disease, like a heart disease or diabetes or COPD or sleep apnea, this is the time to take care of their general medical conditions to optimize the treatment and take care of those as much as possible. And coming back to your allergies, I think those things, please continue to take your regular allergy medications, whatever you do. And there's not much of literature, but I also do tell my patients to do the breathing exercises like the pranayama. They seem to help as well. That's one thing I would suggest. And I've seen two small articles, actually. I do not know how much this is valid, or I think we need to wait and see for more literature. Nasal steam, right? Just like we do nasal steam when we have a cold and cough, for 1 minute nasal steam morning and evening, and rinsing and gargling your mouth with warm water, lukewarm water, it I believe it helps in reducing the viral load. So that's something, if Dr. Deepta or Mahesh have any other thoughts on that. I think that's something small we can do at home. It's very practical. And if it's going to help us during this crisis, I think that's something I would advocate.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Mukund. Dr. Deepta, Mahesh Narayana, would you like to say anything?
Yeah, I can add something here. Just regarding the last article, and I've seen that kind of going around as well. This is just something we've seen in the lab. And, you know, just something about viruses. The viruses are usually coated with fat. And, you know, the anything about 25 to 35 degrees Celsius is able to break that fat down. And so, you know, there's that aspect of breaking the fat down. But the, you know, so it's good to use warm water. But once it enters your body's already 37 degrees. That fat's already degraded. And so it's already at that point, you know, within your system. So I don't know how much of that really, you know, affects the overall virus. I've seen people say, you know, gargle, they're going to the stomach. Most viruses enter the stomach all the time. They, you know, that's kind of what the stomach, you know, if you get food poisoning, that's kind of what it is. So viruses, you know, they're not alive. So you can't really kill the viruses. They have to kind of degrade themselves. And so, you know, a hot water does help for just normal purposes, but I've yet to see any evidence that, you know, warm water or any of that, you know, Flonase or any of those things, steaming, is able to break down the virus itself. But if you're able to do it around you, I certainly see that warmer temperatures around you does break that fat down. So I would, you know, if you're in a colder part of the world right now, I would definitely recommend increasing your temperature to at least 72 degrees or higher. That will actually break down the fat, so it's less likely to be airborne. It'll die very quickly. You know, that's just something I've seen, at least from the scientific perspective. I haven't seen too much evidence in the hot water yet, but again, I could be wrong. I'm not saying that doesn't work. I'm just saying, scientifically speaking, I haven't seen evidence around that.
Thank you, Mr. Mahesh Narayanan. Next question is for Subbaya Rajesh. The number ends with 2345.
Yes, sir.
Subbaya Rajesh.
I'm here. Can you hear me? Okay. First of all,
yeah,
thanks for all the doctors. You know, thanks for all the doctors' support at this time, crisis time. And my question is, like, already, doctor, I think, you know, they already a little bit touched about my question. And it seems like, you know, they were using, like, you know, hydrochloroquine and chloroquine, you know, for this treatment, you know, which is used for malaria. And I'm hearing since yesterday in India, a lot of people, including doctors, they are dying. Now, is it really advisable? Is it approved by IMCR or CDC? Or they are still trying?
I can take one part of the question, and I'm going to ask others to answer the rest of it. It is not approved by FDA for that. That means this drug has not been shown to be active against any of the coronaviruses actively before. They did try the hydroxychloroquine for a short while in SARS and MERS, which are other viruses, coronaviruses, very similar to what we are seeing now, also gave rise to lung infections and fever and severe mortality rate. Did not work on them. So they went back and looked at the same thing in this time too. So any of the world drug administration which process the medications have not approved. FDA, in fact, came here in this country and put out an alert saying it's not approved, do not use it. Many of the people in the United States are also using it on their own, given out prescription given out by the physician, or picking it from patients who have had hydroxychloroquine because they have had lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and other diseases. So we are now seeing a lot of people taking this in a massive number. They've never, ever seen it, so we don't know what it is. When you mentioned people are dying in India, I'm not sure whether it is in the context of the medication or they are dying because of other reasons. Because as far as I see, the number of COVID cases in India are, you know, they are higher than what it was. They're not enormously higher. We do not have a known death due to hydroxychloroquine in this country, except for one patient who took it for one dose or maybe one day on a person from, I think it's not Arizona. That is it. At this point, we do not have any documented case of death related to this medication. But there are many controlled studies being done by all the hospitals. You should probably, if you feel like you want to take it, you give the call a hospital. You can be either a control or you can be a subject itself. And you can get some medication. They'll monitor you, and that is the best way to do it. And one other caveat. Because we have bought hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, they are not available anymore in the pharmacy. So I wanted to give azithromycin for somebody who had severe sinus infection and sore throat, which normally they've been taking. They cannot get the medication. It's not available anymore. So in the process of taking this medication out of using for something which we don't know whether it works or not, we are really depriving of regular people who get better. So that is another thing we need to think about. And hopefully we will get some information. Now I'm going to let the other two, especially Mahesh and others, they can probably give you a better answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate it, Dr.
Mukuna, would you like to add anything to it?
To reemphasize, right now, none of the drugs that are currently being used for treatment for this particular virus has been approved by any body, so any federal body, any international body. So these are just a lot of these are just anecdotal. There are trials that are being run, we're still waiting for that particular results from coming in from those trials. So the clinical trials are just starting at this point. So patients who, as the other doctor mentioned, if you do want to try and take it, please go ahead and register yourself into these trials. And, that actually gives us better data. And that's something that we are struggling right now. We don't have enough patients in a lot of these studies to actually get the results that we need to actually show that it works or not. So if you do want to take it, don't just go ask your doctor for a prescription. You can go ahead and, sign up to one of these trials. It helps both the science, but at the same time, you're also able to get what you need to get without depriving other patients, especially patients with lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, which is what the drugs actually prescribed for and approved for by the FDA. They're not able to get the drug. And so, yes, it definitely puts a lot of patients, not just COVID patients, at risk, but it also puts other patients who actually need the drug at risk, because they're not getting it, and we can't manufacture fast enough for them to get it. So any drug, if it's not approved by the FDA or CDC, take it with caution, because there's really no data to prove it works or not. And a lot of it's just based on anecdotal, information that might or might not be true. So just take it with a grain of salt. If you hear, if you do hear anyone say this works, that's great. We just don't have enough data to show that it works for many people. It might just have worked for one or two people.
Thank you, Manish. Let's move on to the next question. Deepak Pulledi.
Thank you.
The number ends with 8007. Deepak Pulledi? Deepak Pulledi, the number ends with 8007. Okay, let's move on to the next
Hello.
Question. Yeah, Deepak, right now we can hear you.
Hey, I'm from Chicagoland area, so I just wanted to know that, you know, if you, if I do, you know, feel that, you know, I have symptoms or anything, so are there any hospitals that are earmarked for, you know, COVID-19 patients, or do we just go to our, you know, the same primary care physician or the same hospital?
I think Dr. Saraswati, you can take that one.
Yeah.
You are there.
Sure.
You are there. Yeah.
Sure. So I'm from Massachusetts, Boston, Massachusetts. So the way we do it here is if any patient they think they could be having COVID-19, then they call their primary care physician, call them. Do not go to the clinic. Please do call. The phone call is the most important thing now. And the primary care physicians, they're doing something called a telemedicine visit, where you can be in the comfort of your own home, and they use a audio-video, synchronous audio-video system, and they can see you, they can see how you're breathing, they can see the color and color of your skin, and a few things, they are able to assess a few things on this video call as well. So then they'll do the triage. Well, the way we do it is we have to give a, if I want one of my patients to get tested for the COVID-19, I give a prescription and I fax it to the place where the testing is being done. And every 3 days, the testing centers, it keeps changing according to the load of patients they're getting. So we give send a prescription, and then the patient goes there. The prescription is already there in the testing center. They go there, get tested, and then go home straight. We do suggest that if they have access to the mask and gloves, to wear them and go when they're going to the testing center as well, and so they can safeguard themselves and also maintain the 6 feet distance. So that's what we do. And it has to be a similar system as well in Chicago. And so you call your primary care physician, or if it's during Saturday, Sunday hours, please call whoever's on coverage for the team, and they could do a quick telemedicine visit, or they could troubleshoot even over the phone, and they'll be able to guide you. And please also look at the Department of Public Health and Illinois Medical Society. If you go on their website, you can see the hotline numbers, and you can also, they're also very, very informative and useful tools.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Mubana. Next question, the number ends with 0090. Next question, the number ends with 0090. 215-970-0090.
They need to apply *6 or something?
No, they can directly ask.
Okay.
Hello. The number ends with 0090. Maybe you are on the mute. Okay, let's move on to the next question. Gauri, 6009.
Hello,
can you hear me? 6009.
Yeah, can you hear me? Hello.
Yes,
so,
go ahead,
Dr. Sohi here, right? So my question is, like, I mean, I've seen some article last week that this COVID-19 is an airborne disease too, in a CNN article. So my question is, like, whenever you take a flight, at least a domestic flight here, due to unavoidable situation, will we get a chance of, there will be a chance of getting this COVID-19, or how is this? Is it airborne or just through droplets? Because I'll be precautious keeping my hands inside my pocket and while traveling. So can I say that, is it safe if you travel like this?
I can take the question, because we infection control, we do deal with the ventilation. The ventilation system in the airplane are recirculated ventilation. That means they take the air, little air from outside, on the present air, and they mix it, and they keep circulating it, recirculated. It's minimum of, I think, if I'm not mistaken, several recirculations over 1 hour. So that is the ventilation system. And they constantly moved. And they constantly moved in sections. That is maybe the 1 to 10 seats. They will have one section like that. They are in section to section. And so far, and the next issue is, we do know the COVID virus, according to studies, is airborne and can hang in the air about 3 hours. So far, airborne system, as far as we know, has not contributed to the manifested causing illness. It is mainly the fomites touching things and getting them into the face and through the absorption. The cases which have occurred in aeroplanes is probably sitting next to a person because they're actively coughing or you're touching them, or touching the different things in the bathroom or the seats as you walk around. That is the contact they have. We have not had a massive or extensive airborne-related infections in the aeroplane, and the aeroplanes are being kept very clean. So I would suggest, if you are worried about airborne infection and if you have a high risk of a person, you might want to consider, that is, if you have underlying issues where you think that you may be high risk for COVID, you or your family members, you can ask them to wear one of the N95 masks. It may be difficult to find. You can wear that and go. That is probably the best protection. But if you are not worried, probably other than washing your hands nicely and cleaning up your seat and sitting together, and then after your flight, just go again, wash your hands completely, is probably the best thing to do. And I would not worry about travel as much as direct contact with somebody else at work on other area.
Okay. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Thank you, Dr. Deepta. Next question, Susimuthu.
Hello?
Susimuthu, the number ends with 0934.
Hi. Hello? Hello, can I ask the question?
Yeah, yes, go ahead. We can hear you.
Yeah. The first thing I want to ask is that earlier in this call, one of the person was saying that body temperature is around 99 degrees, 99 or something. The thing is that what is the alarming body temperature which we have to take into the consideration? And the next point is that now the season is changing a little bit with the rain, and winter and summer, it's in day by day, the temperature is varying too much. And even a normal person who is in the home is getting a normal cold or some kind of throat infection is there. Is it wise to fear for and going for a testing, or how to take care of it? It may be a normal flu also, or it may be a pollen allergy also. Is there any specific thing to take into the consideration to take it as a COVID or something?
Dr. Muppanna, you want to take that one? Dr. Muppanna, you
want
to answer that? Yeah.
Sure. Sorry, I missed the first part of the question.
No, what is the temperature which is alarming temperature? Which body temperature we have to take into the consideration? Actually, earlier one of the caller was saying he was having a body temperature of 99 or something, but 98 to 99 is a nominal body temperature, I believe. Whether we have to worry about a 99 temperature?
So the CDC recommended actually temperature more than 100.3.
Okay,
that's the temperature which was for the CDC recommendation. And yes, temperature is one main symptom which seems to have occur in majority of the patients, but we also have to look for other associated symptoms if you have any other associated symptoms. But temperature is one big thing, more than 100.3.
More than 100.3. The next question I was asking is that, thank you for the information. The next question is that I said that now due to the changes in temperature day by day, the atmospheric temperature, so one day is rain, suddenly the temperature is going to 60 or something. So there is a continuous changes. The person gets a nominal, the pollen or flu kind of stuff. whether we have to worry for that too also, or we believe that body temperature is good and everything is good, whether we have to worry or we have to go to the primary care or we can take our self-medication or anything.
No, if you think you have seasonal allergies, and if you do take a Claritin or take a Flonase nasal spray, you could continue to do that. Okay, but if there's something more than that, then you should definitely call your primary care physician. But if you're a person who knows you get allergies and it feels like the same thing and no additional symptoms are there, then I think you should continue to monitor and see how you feel.
Yeah, the final question
is... Any change from your normal, you should definitely alert your physician.
Yeah, okay. And the next thing, the last question is that, is a sore throat, it will create a pain or... How it will be? It's sometimes a person gets a cough for every 1 minute. It's not a cough. He will just make a small start of a cough. And he will get a pain or just can cough only is a sore throat pain, intimation in the current situation?
Sure. I think Dr. Saravanan also can jump in and answer this question. But there's something called a post-nasal drip. I think the post-nasal drip can cause a tickle in the back of your throat. That is different, but the sore throat, the sensation of feeling something in the back of your throat and you feel it's hard to swallow and because of some inflammation there, and you feel a few patients of mine, they describe as though they have a lump in the back of the throat and they can feel when they're swallowing, they feel something there and they're more appreciative of what's going on in the back of the throat. So that's the general terminology for a sore throat, which could be one of the symptoms for the COVID-19 as well.
This is Dr. Saravanan. Thanks, Dr. Mopanath. Actually, the caller, thank you very much. These are like a very common questions in everybody's mind, like temperature, yes, 100.3 or above. And before jumping into the sore throat questions, someone else was asking about that. If you feel very sick, phone call, all those things are okay. If you feel very sick, you need to go to the nearest emergency. Very, very sick, you need to call 911. So that basic thing still apply. Do not forget that. When you go to any hospital, like my hospital I'm working, there are a couple of tents. Before they even allow you to the emergency room, they have certain screening procedures. But, and also I want you to keep in mind that hospitals are flooding, okay? Don't overstrain the system or don't get infection from anywhere else, okay? So going back to the sore throat, okay? So, during this dry season changes, you get some dry, you get like a sinusitis or a post-nasal drip. You can very well nicely feel the dry cough, which, goes off with warm water or some pepper or something like that. That is different. And also, you can feel the sore throat, the post-nasal drip as like a warm, watery thing draining into your throat or some salty like feeling, then you get a cough. That cough settled after drinking a water or changing a position. That is post-nasal drip. That can happen a lot during this season. Okay, this pain, as he said, it is a constant pain. It is on the neck. It is on the throat. You cannot feel. You cannot swallow those things. And if it is associated with some short of breath, that is more particular. I think I answered that question. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Saravanan. Next question is for the number ends with 7705. The number ends with 7705. You can ask the question.
Hello, doctor. Thank you so much. This is Nimish. I have a question, like why it is spreading so fast? Even virus is not airborne. So what is the reason behind that? Like it's daily numbers are rising in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. So what's the main purpose or what's the main reason actually?
Can I answer the question? I think the reason is contact. If we lived, each person lived far away from the other and we did not have any contact with each other, the virus will not spread. If you look at it, the virus spread is more in the places where there is a density of people is more. So we can completely prevent the virus from getting into contact with the virus. The virus on both, when it resides on people who have no symptoms, as well as people with symptoms like fever and also some cough and sore throat, runny nose, and muscle pain, diarrhea. The virus is in our body. Without realizing it, we are, you know, by touching our mouth and our nose, we are touching every little spot, and we are coughing, and that is dropping everywhere. And we are spreading this virus all over where we go. Each person has capability of giving the virus to 10 different people. So if we listen to what the CDC and the other hospitals and all your public health people who have requested, don't go outside. Do not go touch anything. It is important. We are not listening to it. We are still living in the United States with the idea that I can go anywhere I want. Just because I'm feeling better, I don't have the virus, I can go touch anywhere, come anywhere. Unless we recognize this is a serious illness, it may affect me, it may affect my whole family, I should follow for the sake of myself and for others. If we don't follow that, we are not going to control the virus. There is absolutely no way we can stop this, you know, unless we come to the way of the lockdown in China. Our government and our public health people were kind enough to give us enough notice to say, please stay home. There is no reason for people to be lining up in Costco and all the stuff. It is difficult. If you want to do it, as we said, maintain distance, try to collect all of it. I'm not saying because I'm proud of it. I have not gone out of the house except for one day to take my friend to the hospital, where I went with her and I was made to sit outside. Twice I went to the hospital. That's it. I've been inside the house from the 17th of this month. I probably don't have COVID, but I feel like as a practicing infectious disease physician, I should do that. And we are maintaining distance at home. Other than the essential people that, like Dr. Mutanna, Dr. Saravanan and others, and people who are running grocery stores and everything else, or people who are running the aeroplanes, nobody else have a reason to go out. This is, you may think that it is an economic problem. I'm not going to earn. My future will depend on it. Please rethink about it. We can always bring back the finance of this country, and we can always bring back your income, because government is going to make a lot of provisions. I am not saying this lightly, because people are going to go through hardship. Do we want that, or do you want a lot of dead people in the house? Along with the regular dead people and older people, we are going to be losing doctors, a lot of emergency room physicians, lot of nurses, lot of EMS people, and one of the close family member who's a pharmacist has now come down with COVID. And she is a primary pharmacist in that office, in that place. Do you want to lose all these talented people? So this is something you really have to get it into your head. And I don't see that seriousness happening in the United States. How did it happen in China? Because it was an autocratic society. The man says you don't do it, and they're used to doing it, and they will arrest and they beat them up, they will do that. We don't want to be like that. We are a better country than that. We are an educated country, better country. We value our freedom. But along with the freedom comes restriction. This virus tells you that unless you behave, I am not going to go. And that is what exactly is happening. We learn to listen to what they said. Maintain the distance. Don't go out. And this is that is the only way this virus is going to disappear. Or we find all the infected people in one shot, two shots, and put them all in isolation and quarantine. That is another way. That's going to be difficult. Or we find a cure, and we have to manufacture it quickly and give it to everybody. That is also not possible. So at this point, the way it's going to be is infection control. Read those things and practice them, please. That is my kind request to everybody, and I hope I can maintain that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Thank you, Doctor. Mahendran, would you like to inform about the COVID-19 task team? Mahendran, can you hear me? Okay, let's go to the next caller. The number that ends with 0747. The number that ends with 0747, you can ask your question.
Hi, this is Sudarshan and Ragini from Tampa, Florida. I'm currently 15 weeks pregnant. My first question is it more serious for the pregnant ladies? And if I get infected with COVID, is it going to also infect my baby and how critical it is? I'm taking my prenatals and I'm taking all the precautions. I haven't left the home in like a month now. Just my husband goes out for groceries once in 2 or 3 weeks. So we are taking all the precautions as much as possible, but the Hillsborough County is having the highest number in Florida. So the cases are increasing. So what all the other precautions I can take and how serious it is because I'm pregnant. I also take oranges, better with vitamin C sources, but what other things I can do to be on the safer side? That's the first question.
Dr. Mupanna, you want to take that one?
Sure. First of all, congratulations. And secondly, I think you are doing all the right things, taking precautions, staying at home. Just call your OBGYN, but do make sure that at least you do telemedicine visits with your OBGYN and ask them what's your next step, like when you do need to come for your regular blood checks and when do you need to come for your regular ultrasound checks or whatever the schedule is, right? That's important. And be also in touch with your primary care physician. Please do take the regular precautions, just like as Dr. Deepta very well spoke, I mean, very heart-touching speech what she gave. Just please make sure that you follow those instructions, regular hand washing and social distancing, not going out. Your husband is doing, he's doing majority, I'm going out to work. But please do make sure that keep away from all the social media. If you need information about the COVID-19, please do go to the regulated websites like CDC, like WHO, and so you can get your really news about the COVID-19. And it's really important to take care of the body, take care of the baby as well. So my thing would be regular hand washing, social distancing, and also making sure that you take your medications, regular follow-up with your OBGYN. Next, coming to answer your second part of the question, if you get the virus, would it go to the baby? There are very, very, very spotty literature. Actually, this morning I was reading, the number of cases we see that is not much, but it's very spotty literature here and there that there is a possibility, just like any other virus, it can affect the baby as well. But I don't mean to, I think just have faith and keep doing all the good things. Dr. Deepta, do you want to add anything else?
Not really. But I think, you know what, just like COVID, you also prevent yourself and making sure that you don't come into contact with any of the people who have normal infections like flu and all that stuff, because even that will affect the baby. And so far, as you said, there is not much of a we haven't seen any literature on the COVID infections on pregnancy. And I think there are maybe about 2 or 3 of small spotty information on patients delivering normal children. So it seems to be at this point that if you don't have any symptoms and during the COVID time, you can probably go through it without having an infection. Or then even if you have an infection, you probably can develop antibody, not symptoms, and deliver the virus. So I won't panic. I have to say congratulations. And you've done a great job of keeping yourself and your baby safely. Continue the same. Thank you.
And may I just add something here quickly?
Please don't forget to exercise.
Yes. So to add on top of that, again, congratulations. It's definitely
a scary time, but, you know, as long as you're taking caution, it's good. Just from the research perspective, you know, we have tried to do at least view this from a mammalian side, and we've done quite a few tests on animals and passing it between progeny, and we have not yet seen any signs of the virus spreading from the mom to the child in mammalian models. So keep that in mind that we are doing this in rodents, not in animal or in humans. It's not exactly the same anatomy, but at least from as close as we can get to humans, we haven't seen any spread from mom to child in any of the rodent studies we've done, and we've also not seen any in the small number of human cases. We've not seen any virus found in the samples of amniotic fluid or breast milk. So even after pregnancy, it's not even if the mom does have the does eventually get the virus or it does have the virus right now, we haven't seen any proof that it can be spread through amniotic fluid or breast milk. So those are, it's not going to be transferred during birth either, or after birth, from what is what we've seen so far in the limited human research. But at least from the mammalian and animal studies we've done so far, we've also not seen any type of evidence to show that it can be passed from the mom to the child, either during pregnancy or after pregnancy. But again, as I've already mentioned, research is very limited. Our number of samples is also very limited. But that's just a positive side from some of the little research we've done in animals that we haven't really seen too much spreading from mom to child.
Okay.
Thank you, Mahesh. Mahesh, I would like to just ask. Yeah, go ahead. You were about to say something?
No, you guys please complete this one first. I have one more question.
So, Mahesh, I have a question for you. Is this going to be a cyclic pandemic?
Great question. Short answer is we don't know. Long answer is, and we probably might know in a couple months. The longer answer is, based on what we know about previous viruses within this category, or within the coronavirus category, they haven't been, but that doesn't mean this one's not going to be. We've seen that these type of viruses, we don't know how COVID-19 is going to react to temperature, but we have done some animal studies that have shown that COVID-19, the ability for it to survive in warmer temperature does slightly decrease as the temperature goes up, but that doesn't mean it's going to go away just because the summer is going to come by. Just with even the seasonal flu, it's not that the seasonal flu goes away in the summer and comes back in late fall or winter. It just likes colder weather and can survive better in colder weather. And we don't know if this type of virus is going to have the same type of effect, which is why even if we're not able to find a cure now, it's going to be very imperative that we do find a cure or some type of vaccine to prevent this from happening in the future. And that's why so many companies like ours and many others are racing to find some type of vaccine, because it could become cyclical or, it can come back later on with some type of mutation. We don't know a lot of that data yet because we're only working with two seasons so far. So we still have two more seasons to go before we can see if it can come back and be some type of a cyclical. But in terms of pandemic, I don't expect it to be another pandemic, if it comes back next year, because we will have better protection. We will have a better immunity as a herd of population. And also we will have at least a few more preventative measures and potentially vaccines ready to go if it does come back next year. So I don't anticipate it being a cyclical pandemic. It could be something like the flu where you have to be cautious and it could come back every year, and we'll have a vaccine for it every year if that's what happens. But I don't expect it to be a whole full-blown pandemic like it was this time, because we just were not prepared for it and we didn't know much about it when it came about. And that's why we're so, we're still struggling to tackle it. But I don't anticipate it becoming a huge problem moving forward.
Thank you, Mahesh. Sure. Dr. Mupanna or Dr. Deepta, would you like to add anything for this question?
No, I think he answered almost all of the points. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Deepta. Let's move on. Go ahead.
Sorry, just a small thing. My thought process is, so we believe or we think that it's going to pass through most of us, right? we could be as it carriers or asymptomatic patients, or we could have mild illness from it, or any severity of the illnesses. And don't we think that it'll form immunity within ourselves, and we shouldn't be getting the pandemic? I really hope we don't get another one. But I'm just saying, this question is for Mahesh. Any thought on that?
Yes, yes. So, I, as I mentioned, I don't anticipate it becoming a pandemic again, at least not this particular virus. And I'm not going to say that we can get rid of all coronaviruses or any mutations that can happen to make this more virulent. But this particular virus, at least for this time period, we should have enough herd immunity moving forward as an entire population that everyone should be protected. But we don't know if it's going to be cyclical, because we don't know how quickly it mutates. It could be the seasonal flu and we need a new vaccine every time, or we can create a vaccine so powerful that we stop it from coming back ever, similar to polio and things like that. So it depends on our treatment and how well we can create one and how long it can last. Sometimes like tetanus, you have to get it every 10 years. It could be like that. So it really depends on what treatments we make and how effective it is in the long run. But at the same time, we also have to figure out how quickly it mutates. And we've seen it mutate pretty quickly. It's already mutated twice as it's been inside human population. So it does mutate, but that's also quite similar to what we've seen in flu. So we're not too worried yet, but if it keeps mutating at this rate in the next 3 or 4 months, that's when we really have to worry, because we need more than just one vaccine. We need one vaccine for every mutation it creates. So hopefully it doesn't get to that point, but I don't anticipate it being another pandemic in next year or in the years coming. I think we'd be more than prepared for that.
Thank you, Mahesh. It was very clear. So, dear callers, whoever is waiting on the Q&A line, please do not repeat your questions. All we have is like 20 minutes, and we have like more than 20 callers waiting in the line. So let's make it as fast as possible. That is one thing due to time constraints. Next thing, Mahendran, would you like to make a quick announcement about the PASS team?
Sure. Thank you, Mani. Thanks to all the speakers. Whoever in the call, this is Mahendran. We have formed a COVID-19 Tamil task team to spread awareness about coronavirus COVID-19. So we are organizing weekly webinars on every Sunday, 8:30 p.m. EST. We'll do this conference call. It will go on until this COVID-19 season. If you have any questions, please email to COVID19TamilTaskTeam@gmail.com. Also visit our website, www.COVID19TamilTaskTeam.org. We are also there in the Facebook. You can sign up in our website to more details. So we look forward to visit our website to know more about us. Thank you, Mani.
Basically, the other thing what we are helping to do is, this is really an important concept. We do have, we try to establish volunteers who can help on over the phone, over the email, and physically. Physically, we screen, we do only healthy volunteers. What basically we are trying to do is we are trying to create a self-help group in every city in New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and Lower Pennsylvania. Also, we are in contact with many organizations. There's one in North Carolina, in Dallas, Michigan, and Washington, D.C. So there are a lot of things. I mean, we just want to support the people. Say, think about it. Somebody in the family, who is here from India, and both parents are sick in the ICU. So those are the areas we are going to help. With that, I finish off my information. Mani, please go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Saravanan. So next question to the number that ends with 4535. 4535, that number ends with 7326924535. Can you hear me? Okay. So let's move on to the next person. Number ends with 6713. Senthil Nithya. Senthil Nithya, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Just want to ask, first of all, thank you everyone for doing this. Just want to ask a question about anything like a mosquito or any insects that can transmit this disease other than droplets from the air?
No, sir. No insect vector at this point. No.
Thank you, Dr. Deepta. So let's move on to the next question. The number that ends with 9821. The number that 982 ends with 9821. You can shoot your question.
Hello. Thank you, Dr. This is Kamal here. Am I audible?
Can you please speak up? We could not hear you clearly.
Okay. Am I audible, sir?
Yes, very good. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, doctors, and thank you, everyone, for this opportunity. My question is, like, if the symptoms are being the same for adults and kids, that is question number one. And the two is, like, does the vitamin C helps to stay away from this COVID-19, or will that help in any way? That's all my two questions.
Dr. Saraswati, you want to take the question? You see patients?
But sorry, I couldn't hear. The second part of the question is regarding vitamin C.
Hello. Sorry.
Hi, could you just repeat your question once again, please?
Yeah, the question is more like for the kids and adults, the symptoms are same for COVID-19. And the second is, by taking vitamin C, will that help in the current situation?
Pediatric age population, we've not seen much of the COVID-19. We have seen it more in adults, starting from anywhere from 20 years onwards. We've been seeing more and more cases these days. And so in the pediatric population, they could still be having fever, running nose, cough, these symptoms. I'm not sure about the abdominal symptoms, whether they have diarrhea or not. I do not know about that part. And the second part of the question is regarding vitamin C. And one more thing regarding the pediatric age group, if they're irritable, they're crying a lot, those are other things, those are other pointers which have to make us call the pediatrician and inform them. So those are a few things. And to do with the vitamin C, it's helps in boosting immunity, vitamin C. If you do take, you can take one vitamin C a day. But intravenous vitamin C, there are some studies regarding that treatment as a possible treatment for COVID-19. But oral vitamin C in a normal person to boost the immunity, that's one thing you could do, just like you do ginger, turmeric, and other things. But I've not seen any literature on taking oral vitamin C to combat COVID-19 per se.
Thank you, Dr. Mupanna. Oh. Let's move on to the next question. The number that ends with 2446. You can ask the next question. The number that ends with 2446. Can you hear me?
Hi.
The number that ends with 2446. Go ahead, sir, please.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for everyone. This question is like, is there any further impact or side effect, some organ damage who are already impacted and recovered from the COVID-19?
Can I take this?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So long-term outcomes, right? Patients have, it depends on the severity of the COVID-19 that they've experienced. So patients can be having low oxygen numbers, as I said. They could go into respiratory failure due to lack of oxygen. It's called acute hypoxic respiratory failure. Or they can go also into multi-organ dysfunction syndrome. And patients might have to be on a ventilator for some time. And there's something called ECMO. They could be on that as well. But I've seen little literature on saying if there could be some kind of fibrosis or a little bit of scarring in the lungs. And I've also seen literature where there are no long-term effects on the lung. So I've seen both. I think time will tell. We need more literature on this.
Oh,
thank you, doctor. So let's move on to the next question. The number that ends with 8162. The number that ends with 8162, you can ask your question.
Hey, hi. Thank you, doctors. This is Kishore from Pennsylvania. I just want to thank for one of our friends from New Jersey for sharing his experience. It's, I know it's very hard to sustain the weeks of time with the 99 degrees fever and self-quarantine with, along with the family. So we hope our prayers will make him test, which is going tomorrow, will become negative. So my question is, how is the trend in U.S.? Is that fever almost most of the cases, the people are getting 100 or 99 fever? Or at what would be the alarming point where I should get alarmed, like I have been, there would be chances of the corona infections? So is that fever is happening for most of the cases?
So may I take this? And if Dr. Deepta can also fill in, that'll be nice.
Thank you. You sure. Go ahead, sir.
Sure. So fever is known to occur in 88% of the patient population. It is one common symptom that is very well known. That's why you see everybody, they think about temperature scanning and everything else. And that's one part. So there could be also some patients who don't need to have the fever still carry the virus. So it's both ways too. Dr. Deepta?
Your question is mainly what are the symptoms of the fever and what was the other point you wanted?
No, basically, so in U.S., how is it happening? The cases, whatever we are going through so far, most of the people are getting infected with fever. And we recently heard in Chicago, less than a one-year baby got infected with the virus and is passed away. So we just kind of, how the trend in U.S., it is the people are getting with the coming with the symptoms of fever is most of the cases.
There are about 15 to 20% of the people will not have fever, but they may have shortness of breath, they may have runny nose, sore throat, dry cough, diarrhea, abdominal symptoms, and as we mentioned before, even loss of a smell. But all are followed by fever. Usually this might last for 2 to 3 days, then the fever starts in. And many of them have high fevers of 102, 103, which kills. Some have only about 100.3, and that is basically where it is. The fever becomes eventually a symptom. Occasionally, in some older people, shortness of breath becomes a primary symptom, which brings them to the hospital, and then they look at the blood work and all that. But for a regular common person, you should be aware that the fever will eventually be there. And if you have a fever, that becomes an issue. Number two, about the trend. We are unable to predict. The way we are going now, we thought maybe we would be peaking at this point. We'd be coming through a dip. It's not. I think primarily because social distancing is not happening and self-quarantine at home by people are happening. People are still traveling knowing that the coronavirus is positive. And so if you ask my opinion, I was totally surprised at the rapid jump of cases which has gone on. We have now almost crossed what had happened in China. China only had 80,000 cases. I think today CDC this afternoon, if it meets now, has totaled 85,000 and more, and up to, out of which close to 80 is confirmed, 85 is pending. So we have crossed China at this point, and it is peaking in all the places. The many places which have had, they're all going up. If you are, if we are peaking, or if you're being, we are recognizing cases now, that means people will be coming down with the illness even 10 to 14 days down the road. That is, many of them have incubation period up to 10 to 11 to 12 days. So that gives us another 2 weeks. So other 2 weeks, we are going to continue to have elevation of number of cases. And the death rate even lags behind. The death rate will be even after you come down with the cases incidence, the death rate will continue to go because people who have been sick or kept in the hospital, they die longer and they take longer to die. So I think it is a very sad situation. And I, with all due honesty, please do not listen to any of those news and any of the other political people who say that we, it's all hoax and it's not there. Take this very seriously from scientific point of view. We haven't seen the peak yet. So I think it's going to continue to rise and it's going to expose more people unless, starting today, everybody whoever listens and talks to others and contain themselves, restrict themselves with their activity. And the ATMA and AAPI were the forefront to ask the president and all of the associations to start lockdown, actually. We wanted to talk, we talked about it 3 weeks ago. And I feel that, however draconian those measures sounded, if we have instituted some amount of lockdown in New York, we might not have come to this level because this virus needs that kind of a treatment. And we have learned it from other countries. If you don't follow that, you're going to continue. So seriously, our leaders in the national level have to take that measure and provide all the support they need for the citizens to continue to follow as much as you can distancing and self-quarantine at home of yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thank Deepta. You. Let's move on to the next question. The number that ends with 9668. The number that ends with 9668, please shoot your question.
Sure. This is Murthy Nair from Michigan, and thank you very much for organizing this. It's a very useful thing. I have three questions. The question number one is, some medicines like ibuprofen and other things which we take for like a regular fever type of thing, some are mentioning like we should not take that. That is question number one. Question number two is like the fever. Once the onset of fever, will it go through a cyclic phase, like it will be there for 2-3 days and then subside again, it will go on for the next couple of days, again subside type of thing. The third one is like the organ impact, how this impacts the liver and as well as like when it impacted the lungs, whether it can able to, like lungs can regenerate its, I mean the sense means it will recover itself or not. Those are three questions. Thank you.
So, Dr. Deepta, do you want to take the first question? I can take the rest too.
I didn't hear the first question. It was a two or three. So
ibuprofen. Ibuprofen is one.
Yes. Ibuprofen has been theoretically shown to probably have some effects, adverse effects on people who are infected with coronavirus. And this is primarily because it has affinity for the spike protein projection. It can make that come out and there'll be more attachment of the virus to that. And then you have more release of what we call cytokines and the damage which is done. So theoretically, it has been said that it probably should not be used. We don't have much of practical information, so that is what is being suggested. So aspirin also will come in the group, aspirin, ibuprofen, and the advice is to give Tylenol to many of the people. And for people who are on aspirin for coronary artery disease prevention or vascular, they can continue that. And if they are admitted to the hospital, it depends on the people who are managing them at the hospital, whether they will continue or they may give them different kind of medication. I think try not to take for your fevers and muscle pain, ibuprofen and other NSAIDs too. There was one or two cases where they've used it for naproxen and cough inhibitors. So others also had been advised, but definitely ibuprofen is a no-no at this point. Thank you.
So I think one of the questions was regarding will it affect other organs? Will the COVID-19 affect other organs? Yes. Later on in the disease process, when it's not mild or severe anymore and becomes critical, that time it does affect the other organs. It affects the heart, and it also affects the liver. It affects the kidneys. That's what we call as a multi-organ dysfunction syndrome. So all the mods and patients can go into a state of shock that time, and people can die as well. So that's one part of the question. The other thing is to do with the lungs. It's mainly the lungs get affected. You could see spots. They're called ground glass opacities. That's how we describe it on a CAT scan. Those are nothing. It's mainly, you can see just like a ground glass, how it looks. That's how the lungs might have those spots within the lungs as well, and which you can see on a CAT scan of the chest. And then the oxygen carrying capacity in the lung is affected because of that, and the oxygen level starts coming down. And because the lungs are affected, and cough and shortness of breath could be the earliest symptoms on, along with fever. Does that answer your questions?
One more question, actually. I mean, regarding the fever topic. So once the fever started, I mean, how long does it last? And whether it follow a pattern like it will be there for 2 days, again, there will be a drop. Again, it will rise up for another 2 days and then drop, kind of thing.
So cyclical fever, if that's your question, whether, you know, in certain types of malaria, you could see that, cyclical fever. I've not seen any papers where the fever can be there for 2 days or 3 days and then form a cyclical pattern. I've not come across that. Any other, Mahesh or Dr. Deepta?
No, I have not heard of cyclical fever either. Thanks.
Yes, this is Mahesh here. I just had two comments here. One is, at least in animal models, we have not seen any cyclical fever related to COVID-19. So we have not seen that, and it looks like, you know, even with patients, that's not been the case. And one other aspect is in terms of ibuprofen or any non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. The reason we don't recommend, those type of NSAIDs during any type of viral attacks is because the reason you're getting the fever is that your body's trying to fight it, and these are anti-inflammatory drugs, which are pretty much restrict your immune system from trying to fight it. So what we've seen in animal models is that the reason we don't we ask patients not to take ibuprofen is because it lowers their fever, but that also lowers the temperature that's optimum for your T cells to fight the virus. And that actually, and this is what we've seen, is that that's actually causing the virus to obviously spread even faster, and the body's not able to fight it. So that's one aspect of ibuprofen or any type of NSAID we avoid, or we should recommend avoiding during any type of viral infections. And acetaminophen should definitely be prescribed because it does restrict the immune system's ability to fight the virus, which is the main thing that we want it to do, and not stop from doing it. So just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Mahesh. Just one last follow-up question. Basically, since fever is being the primary symptom, can it safe to say, like, if we have fever continuously for 2 days, that is the time that we have to, like, take action, contacting the doctors and things like that, or do we need to take, is there any timeline that we have to wait for the fever?
For a significant fever, the definition of fever in infectious diseases 100.3 continuously for two 6 hours apart. That is how we define fever. So it does need not have to be 2 days. If you have fever for 2 hours, 2 days, 2 6-hour period of 100.3, then you have something in your body. So you need to then take precautions. So it goes on to follow to say that you probably have something. That is how we usually define fever for infectious diseases. Below 100.3, low-grade fever could be related to so many other things like hydration and others. So low-grade fever, it needs to be at least for 24 hours. Then you can say it's a fever at that point and continue again maybe another day. So definitely 100.3 is not a normal temperature for body. You have 2 6-hour, 8-hour period of 100.3, something is wrong with you.
Sure.
Thank you, Dr. Deepta. So let's move on to the next question, the number that ends with 3941. Callers, we have a very, very less time. In case if we cannot, the people who are waiting in the queue already, in case if we cannot complete all your questions, please do email your questions to COVID19TamilTaskTeam@gmail.com. That is spelled as COVID, D as in David,
number one, number nine, tamiltaskteam@gmail.com. So right now, the next caller, the number ends with 3941. Please shoot your question.
Hi, this is Saranya. I have just one question. Like for type 1 diabetes patients, is the risk more even though if we keep our blood sugar, even though if we maintain the blood sugar, and if at all if we are seeing any symptoms for the COVID-19, should we go to the hospital immediately or can we isolate like other normal people?
Can I take this, please?
Yeah, Saraswati, it should be you, yes.
Okay. So type 1 diabetes, right? Whatever medications you take at home, the insulin and whatever you take at home, you should continue to take them, be very vigilant, maintain a healthy lifestyle in terms of diet and exercise. So all those precautions, what you would normally take, you should continue to take them. But if you develop any symptoms, like any of these COVID, already we explained those symptoms, if you develop any of those symptoms, you should definitely call your primary care physician. And if it comes to, if the symptoms are any alarming, then you should definitely go to the emergency room. You should not even wait. Call 911 or go to the urgent care or go to the emergency room. As Dr. Saranan initially pointed out, there's no two ways about it at all. If you feel, in spite of all anything, if there is a severe symptom or anything which warrants you, and you say that you should have a very low threshold and say, yes, I am going to call 911. Or I am going to go to the emergency room. You should not wait till the next day morning. That would be my suggestion.
Thank you, Dr. Mupanna. So the next question is going to be the last question for today. The number that ends with 8884. Please shoot your question.
Hey, this is Kumar from State of Washington. I have a general question that since like there are some low-profile families up there. If a family lives in a single bedroom and they have only one restroom in the bathroom, so what are the medical advice you if you know if the person gets COVID-19?
I think what you're asking is a very, very valid question because we are all talking like as if people are living in multiple bedrooms. It is very difficult, but I think if you have a person who has got COVID-19 in a one-bedroom house, one-bedroom place, what I would suggest is look to see who the others are. If you have anybody else in the family who is at a higher risk, like they have uncontrolled diabetes or diabetes, heart problem, they have chronic lung disease, or they are on cancer therapy, or somebody who is age-wise older, you scare us away, you could request take this person and then have them live with another person for the next 14 days. That would be great. That is what probably you need to do. I think you can probably make use of your network of friends, family, and try to put them in another place. That is number one. Number two is if you can isolate yourself, if you can afford to go to a hotel room and stay yourself for the 14 days and the family can supply the food or something like that, that is number two. If these two options are there at home, you should wear an N95 mask and you should try to keep yourself to one area wherever it's possible. Maybe if you're kind of a person who wants to have a bed, separate bed for you, and stay in that one area and they can bring the food and everything to your area. And you can go to the bathroom and wash yourself and then clean the toilet and all of the area with any one of the Lysol or Clorox spray or something else. Get back to yourself and you take all of your clothes and your sheets and your towel and you keep them yourself and you wash them periodically by yourself and fold them and keep it to yourself. This is the only way you can survive. So that is probably the best way you can isolate yourself in a scenario like this. But wearing a mask for you is important, the one who's COVID positive, because any droplet, anything which comes out of the mouth is going to transmit the disease. And not touching, people being aware of it, limiting your movements, to one corner or one area, just say that everything needs to be brought over to you. It is very hard. It is possible. Social network is the way to go for this. Call all your friends, your children's schoolmates. They can probably go stay with their best friend's house and things like that. And, you know, try to help them. You know what? This is a time where as a humanity, we need to open up our hearts and our minds and even our wallets and to help everybody who is possible. And this is a bad disease as it is. And, you know, any one of us who have room and to board people whom we know very well or our friends, let them give them a chance to stay with us. I think that will be my suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Deepta. So for the callers who are remaining in the queue, please do send your questions to the email address COVID9TamilTaskTeam@gmail.com. So your questions will be, we will get the answer from the doctors and get back to you. Thank you very much for waiting
Mani,
all this time.
Mani,
yes.
Mani.
Doctor.
This is Dr. Saravanan Ramalingam. There are a lot of questions. We're going to have one more session next week. In between, if anything urgency, please send email and visit the website. We'll get the experts like Dr. Deepta, Dr. Mupana, Mahesh, and we have other experts too. We'll try to answer your question back as soon as possible. And also, there is a helpline if there is a really, something you want to talk to us, call the helpline number. And the last question is a really very good question. That is a problem a lot of people are facing, and there is the Dr. Deepta's answer was excellent. That's really very useful for so many families. Thank you very much, Dr. Deepta, and everybody
you.
For.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Thanks for Dr. Deepta Nirnijalian, Dr. Saraswati Mupanna, and Mr. Makesh Narayanan for educating the whole community regarding this COVID-19. And people who joined us, hopefully this call was very useful for everyone. And please do visit us at COVID19TamilTaskTeam.org. We do have an FAQ page. Please go ahead and visit there. A lot of common questions are answered there. And anything else, please call us. Our hotline number is 201-540-9198. I'll repeat it. It's 201-540-9198. You can call 24/7. There will be always people attending the call. Thank you.
Thank you
very
much for the opportunity. Also, other speakers. Thank you.
Thank you
so
much,
and thank you to all the healthcare workers and all the scientists working on this. We will get through this.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye bye. Good night.
Good night.